We are going to do something so good and so fast and so strong, and the world is going to respect us again. Believe me.
Together, we are going to create an economy that works for all of us, not just the 1%.
You just wait. Let me tell you, there's so much going to happen. If you don't have a seatbelt, go get one. We're going to shake this country from top to bottom.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09. Today is February 10th, 2016. Whatever kind of business you're in today, you're going to need a pair of long underwear and maybe some gloves if you're in Chicago. It is very, very cold. If you're headed out this morning, make sure you bundle up and bring some gloves. Today is also Ash Wednesday, the start of Lent for Catholics across the country, around the world. And there will be services and people will be taking off today to go and get blessed with ashes. It is also a busy day in the business world. Today's Janet Yellen's day, at least the first day on Capitol Hill. She will testify before Congress. But first, let's do your global market intel. Asian stock markets fell for a third consecutive night overnight, beset by nerves about a shaky global economy. Failing oil prices contributing to this. Also, capital shortfalls at major European banks. Investors are questioning whether those European banks, like Deutsche Bank, have sufficient capital to take care of the slump and the annual loss that they're recording. Despite assurances, though, from the German bank, some analysts expect it will need to issue new shares to raise billions of dollars, and that pushed down the markets overseas, and they're still down this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just 13 points yesterday. The Standard & Poor's fell about a point, less than 1.1%. The NASDAQ Composite lost 14 points as tech stocks at least appeared to do a little bit better yesterday. Benchmark U.S. crude oil is back above $28, but still below $30. It lost $1.75 yesterday. The dollar fell against the yen. Well, as I mentioned, Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen testifies for 2 days on Capitol Hill beginning today. Since the Fed raised rates in December from record lows, the economic landscape has been rocky, to say the least. Goldman Sachs chief economist Jan Hatzius.
I think she needs to walk a fairly fine line between not appearing like she's completely ignoring the turmoil in the markets, but at the same time also to indicate that she still expects expansion and that the scenario that that the Fed has laid out, the forecast the Fed has laid out, is still the basic view.
Lawmakers will also want to question Yellen about the probable pace of further rate hikes this year. Law enforcement, first responders, and the medical community applauding Deerfield-based Walgreens today. Their decision to make the heroin overdose antidote drug naloxone available without a prescription at pharmacies in Illinois and 34 other countries. Richard Ashworth is Walgreens president for pharmacy and retail operations.
As a pharmacy, we could and we should do more. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Many suburban police departments, some schools have been stocking this drug since 2014. It's credited for saving 100 lives in DuPage County and 55 lives in Lake County. Well, we've always been told our natural resources like water and air are invaluable, but a research team has developed an equation that's put a price tag on each raindrop and breath of fresh air we take. And they say we need to start treating nature like an investment portfolio. This morning on The Opening Bell, we talked to the lead researcher of the Yale-led team. Eli Fennekel of Yale is with us via Skype this morning. Eli, let's start first by, you know, what you've done here. What is this equation?
Okay, what we've done is we've developed an approach to look at assets that sit in nature and come up with a way of imputing a price for them that allows an apples-to-apples comparison, traditional assets that we can go to a market and look at the price for. So what prices do, even in the market, is they value the incremental unit of the asset. So even though, as in our case study, we look at groundwater, and water is incredibly valuable. And that last drop of water, people would probably pay an infinite amount for. The next drop of water taken out of an aquifer, you know, people have a finite interest in valuing that water and in paying for that water. The important thing about prices is they tell us as things become more scarce or become rarer. And so they're a good measure of just where are we in that range of how critical is it right now?
In your study, you have used the idea or the notion of this groundwater in Kansas, in the aquifer in the High Plains. Tell us about your example.
The High Plains is in Kansas is an important food-producing region. Most of the groundwater in this region actually goes into crop agriculture. It goes into, I think, five different crops. And what we're able to do is we're able to look at how farmers hold water out of the aquifer to put into their crops, in part in response to how much water they had left in their aquifer. We also were able to look at which crops they chose to grow. And we were able, from that, to back out how much future production are they giving up by using water today. That's what the value of that water is, because that's what capital does, is it helps us move wealth from now till tomorrow. Pulling down capital today is like taking money out of your bank account. It's not there to spend it tomorrow. And that's how we're able to back out the appropriate capital asset price for the groundwater.
And so after you figure this out, the amount that Kansas lost in terms of dollars was quite significant.
The amount that Kansas took out of their groundwater aquifer was quite substantial, yes. I don't really know what Kansas did with, you know, we knew they grew crops, and it's conceivable that they invested a lot of the proceeds from the crops back in other forms of capital. It's also conceivable that they didn't, and they consumed a lot of imports and spent the money. Just like somebody who has a bank account can pull money out of their bank account and they can invest in stocks or bonds or real estate, and their overall wealth could actually continue to grow even though their bank account got smaller, or they could pull the money out of their bank account and go have a big party. What we think is really important here is these kinds of measures are critical to be able to make wise decisions about how we use resources and how we make investments, from either investing in resources or how much of the resource, when we withdraw a resource, how much of the proceeds need to be reinvested in other forms of capital.
We're talking with Eli Fennecle, an assistant professor at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, lead author of a new study. By the way, that price tag we were talking about with the Kansas groundwater, $110 million per year between 1996 and 2005. That's a total of $1.1 billion.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Asian stock markets fell for a third consecutive day on news about shaky global growth, falling oil prices, and possible capital shortfalls at major European banks. Stateside, the Dow's fell 13 points. The S&P 500 shed 1.25 points. The Nasdaq lost 15. Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen has a busy 2 days on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers are looking for hints about possible future rate hikes. Even Mercedes-Benz is not immune from airbag issues. Daimler AG is recalling 840,000 cars and SUVs in the United States because they have potentially defective driver's side airbags. The company says the recall is precautionary and that no one has been injured in any of its vehicles. Could this be the end of race cars plastered with logos? NASCAR plans an overhaul of its business model, shifting to a franchise-like system that relies less on sponsorships. Since 1948, drivers and their teams have depended heavily on the advertisers whose names grace their cars. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. We're back with Eli Fennecle, an assistant professor at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, lead author of a study that appears today in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In the study, Eli, your team shows it's possible to price natural capital, things like water and air. What do you hope that the world's leaders do with this new equation?
Well, I hope it impacts their future planning, because I think we entrust our governments to manage a rich portfolio of assets for us that include the assets they typically think about, which are things like roads, as well as education and health, but also the natural assets. And again, this is why making those apples to apples comparisons are so important. You know, I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback on this, but, you know, looking back, without the kinds of measurements that we're producing, it must be really hard for a policymaker to make wise decisions. That's why we think these measurements are so important, is we hope it will allow policymakers to make more thoughtful decisions about managing our collective wealth that we've basically entrusted them to manage for us.
And so how do you think your study is going to impact the future discussion and management of climate change that seems to be on a lot of people's minds? Will it help governments plan for climate change and the impacts that it might bring?
I think it can. One of the interesting things about climate change is that it's going to, for some forms of natural capital, it could actually be moving them around and really redistributing wealth, which I think is, you know, that's a big topic in our society writ large. Is, I mean, if you listen to politicians, some want to reallocate wealth, some don't want to reallocate wealth. And a big part of our wealth is actually stored in natural capital. The World Bank put out a report in 2014 that estimated about 28% of global wealth is stored in natural capital. And then they go on to say they're pretty certain that's an underestimate. And so when you have things like climate change potentially moving certain kinds of wealth around, like fish or forests, that's a big reallocation of wealth, whether we want it or not. And hopefully people and our politicians will be able to think carefully about what does that mean in terms of investment to preserve wealth in various regions, or for some regions, perhaps windfalls they're going to receive, and they can plan accordingly to make smart investments. It seems really important to me for sustainability with or without climate change that we maintain a good, strong base to allow future generations to produce and consume like we are today. And that's what capital allows us to do. And so we need to know how important our natural capital is in playing into those processes. And we've tried to create measures, and our paper is showing people how you can go out and measure those values of natural capital conditional on the way we're measuring today. And that's also really important because those values can go up if we improve management, or they can go down if we make poor management decisions.
Up until now, we've had the discussion with climate change about, you know, whether it's happening, if it's happening, what the impact is going to be. But when people start seeing dollar figures and zeros and zeros and zeros added to costs, does that make it more real to them?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. When policymakers or decision makers start seeing, the problem is they kind of come up with a spreadsheet, and one has good dollar plus and minus when they're trying to do a benefit cost analysis, and then they have some qualitative pluses and minuses. And I think what happens is those qualitative pluses and minuses get downweighted, and the information that has better measured dollar values gets upweighted in the decision process. I don't know if it makes climate change more real or less real, but I suppose that what our framework allows you to do is think of climate change as a risk. And so you don't have to actually weigh in on whether or not you think climate change is real or not. You can think, well, if there's some probability of climate change, our framework can be easily adapted to account for that risk. And so you can start worrying about the probability of a climate change. And so somebody who really, really was skeptical of climate change, but not 100% confident, might say there's, you know, a small probability of climate change. And somebody else might say there's a big probability of climate change. And our framework would let them sort of come up with different prices for the asset and different investment strategies, but they'd be able to start thinking also about hedging risk. And so maybe we would get past sort of arguments yes, no, in a more sophisticated way of worrying about insuring ourselves against potential big environmental changes like climate change.
Because you mentioned it there, investment risk. That's another good way of looking at this is, you know, if you have a portfolio that's constantly losing money and a lot of money, well, you're going to do something to change it, aren't you?
I would hope so. I certainly think that if you saw asset managers managing a portfolio that lost $110 million a year for 10 years in a row, you'd probably change those asset managers. It is important to see these numbers and sort of question, are we on a good path or not? And I think as we have more and more data available to us and better digital technology to sort of wrangle these data, we should ask more of the stewards of our collective wealth portfolios, which includes nature and natural resources, to do due diligence and do the best job they can to measure these things. And ask, are the decisions and the way we're using resources actually increasing our own collective wealth, or are we drawing it down too quickly?
Eli Fennekel is an assistant professor at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, lead author of a new study that actually puts a price on our natural resources. And his study appears in the National Academy of Sciences today. This is the opening bell on 720 WGN. Coming up on the news, President Obama is in Springfield today. Vic will have that coming up, and then more of the opening bell. Stay with us. It's 527.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again. Welcome back to the program. Our conversation takes us now to Dan Egan, who is the director of investing for Betterment.com. They are a firm that's focusing on a relatively new area of behavioral finance and investments. And Dan is on Twitter at Daniel_Egan, E-G-A-N. Dan, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you know, there are lots of CEOs and advisors and analysts in the community who know exactly what you do. But for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with behavioral finance, give us a little, like, 1 or 2 minute lesson here.
Absolutely. So my role is to understand how human psychology intersects with how people invest and try and help our customers be better investors. So the simplest way to form a very profitable investing strategy is obviously to buy low and sell high. Unfortunately, our emotions tend to drive us to do the opposite, to worry and to panic when the market is falling and to get excited and a little bit greedy when it's rising. That's just one example of a behavioral bias that can affect our investing behavior and can actually reduce customers' returns or cause them to miss their financial goals over the course of their life. So my role is to figure out how do we take some of those same behavioral biases and use them to help people be better investors rather than worse investors.
And so there enters Betterment.com, and the firm is focused on that and also sort of taking a little bit of the people, I don't want to say taking people out of these decisions and out of the market help, but it's, you know, some have called you guys robo-advisors and, you know, there are other terminology, but tell us how Betterment.com works.
Sure. So Betterment is a direct-to-consumer website that is a very cost-effective investment advisor and manager. We provide financial advice and investment advice at extremely low cost, anywhere from 0.35% to 0.15% of assets for each customer per year, which is about one-tenth of the cost of your standard financial advisor. We invest you in a completely diversified portfolio of very low-cost ETFs. We give you goal-based advice. So we sort of separate out, okay, you have a retirement goal, and let's focus on the type of advice and information that we need to invest well for that. You have a house down payment goal. You have a wedding goal. You have a kid's college education goal. Each one of those is separated out so that we can focus on prioritizing them and getting them properly funded. And then Betterment takes over the nitty-gritty of managing the portfolio day-to-day, reinvesting dividends, rebalancing the portfolio, harvesting tax losses to reduce your end-of-year tax bill. Everything that a very good investment advisor would do, we're able to do using technology, and it's always on, it's always available for you, and it's much less expensive than having a human do it.
And gone are the days, I suppose, that, you know, when everybody thinks of financial investors, I mean, the first scene that comes into my brain is Wall Street, the movie, where you just have a room of, right. You know, those days are over, aren't they?
You know, I think more and more investors are learning that the only way to win is to not play Wall Street's game. And that's what we do. We're not trying to beat the market. We're not trying to trade a lot and generate a lot of commissions for a bank. We're trying to do the exact opposite. We, as I said, use very low-cost ETFs that are very liquid so that we're paying as little as possible in management expenses as well as commissions to sort of get in and out of the market. And we don't try and time it. A lot of research has showed that the more that you try to beat the market, the worse you're going to do. So rather than try to play and lose, we just make sure that we're investing the right way for our customers rather than trying to beat the market.
I saw one expert write about your company recently that you have rebuilt the plumbing of financial services. Is that a fair assessment?
We are definitely one of what they say in the technology world is the whole stack providers, right? So the plumbing from the very bottom to the very top, this is a business model that's probably most familiar in terms of Apple building both the hardware that goes into the iPad and iPhones as well as the software that runs it. And that gives us a lot of advantages in terms of being able to do things that other financial firms aren't that really benefit our customers. Everything from we are one of the first firms to get our tax statements out the door because of the fact that we actually are running them ourselves for customers. We're not dependent upon anybody else's documents coming in later and later and later in the year. there's a lot of benefit to being focused on doing a few things very well. Betterment is not sort of a free-for-all trading site where you can come in and do everything. We focus on building really good portfolios and managing them very well for people. That means that we just built a very focused, specialized set of technology to do that extremely well. And it does mean that we're far less expensive and always on, always available to our customers, something that a lot of other companies can't say.
And we have about a minute or so left, but I was also surprised to see that based on your service, more than half of the clients that your company serves decide not to make transactions in many cases. And almost 80% of them decide that the transactions are prevented because of some, you know, emotional decision. Those are high numbers.
So one of the things that is a real sort of judo trick that we've done with behavioral finance is we know that people get emotional when the market's going down, for instance, and they may be tempted to run for the hills, sell all of their stocks. One of the things that people don't realize is that obviously if you sell after your investments have appreciated, you're going to owe tax on that. And so what we do is we give people a preview of the tax that would be incurred if they sold their stocks. Now, one of the funny things is that we Americans tend to hate taxes probably more than we hate losses. So we find that actually informing people of the tax cost of going through with that selling transaction greatly reduces how often people try and time the market, which is it's not necessarily unbiasing them, but it's definitely putting some brakes on some dangerous behavior.
And very timely now with the latest on the markets. This last month or so has been kind of one of those rough patches where I bet a lot of people are doing a lot of panic trading and selling.
Well, you know, one of the things we do is turn lemons into lemonade. We have a automated tax loss harvesting service, which is constantly on and checking your portfolio for tax losses. Obviously, we're already looking at being able to tell our customers if they have a large enough account that you're going to have $3,000 worth of tax offsets to reduce your tax bill at the end of 2016. So there's definitely a silver lining to markets such as these.
Dan Egan is the director of investing for Betterment.com. You can go there and taste the lemonade if you want. They're focused again on innovation, and this is a behavioral finance and investment firm. Daniel Egan, Daniel_Egan, E-G-A-N on Twitter. Dan, thanks for being on the Opening Bell this morning.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 550. Dow futures higher this morning, up 116. The S&P futures are up 17. Asian markets are mixed. The Nikkei off 372. European markets are higher this morning. Let's find out how the commodities market did yesterday. And here's Orion Samuelson.
Stock market quieted down a little bit yesterday, and as a result, cattle futures did too, although we ended lower after traders sold the February contract and then bought the deferred months while awaiting cash prices that will be coming up later this week. At the end of the day, only the February down $1.20 a hundredweight, but April live cattle gained 25 cents a hundredweight to close at 131.65. The April feeder cattle contract ended $1.15 higher at $150.12. The government issued the February crop report yesterday, raising corn and wheat supplies because exports have quieted down. USDA pegged global wheat ending stocks for the 2015-16 crop year at 238.8 million tons, and global ending corn stocks were seen at 208.8 million tons. U.S. wheat stocks raised to a six-year high of 966 million tons. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Back here on the Opening Bell, President Obama has asked Congress for $19 billion to boost cybersecurity funding across all government agencies to help protect reams of critical data from cyber attacks. It's called the Cybersecurity National Action Plan.
As we've seen in the past few years and just in the past few days, cyber threats pose a danger not only to our national security, but also our financial security and the privacy of millions of Americans.
ABC News correspondent Bozzy Kanani is in the Washington Bureau this morning and joins us via Skype. Bozzy, what has the president proposed?
Part of this is that it's part of his new budget that he has just sent to Congress, his budget proposal that includes $19 billion to upgrade cybersecurity across all government agencies. And about $3 billion of that would be spent just on overhauling what the president calls ancient computer systems in the federal government. One example that he gave today was he pointed out that the Social Security Administration is still relying on some systems from the 1960s. The other thing that the president announced today is that the White House is creating this new position for a high-level federal official whose job it will be to coordinate cybersecurity across all government agencies, civilian defense, and intelligence agencies, and also to drive policy and change in those areas.
There are a lot of people who say this is long overdue just because of the giant threat that security online and these attacks pose. Is that something that you're hearing, that this is also a long overdue?
Well, you know, in our nation's intelligence agencies, this is not a new threat. I mean, this is something they have been working on. At the same time, the president did acknowledge today that he feels we're still really catching up to this threat, that we're not where we need to be, and that certainly not only do we need to catch up, but we need to look ahead and be prepared for what's coming down the road in the future.
And this is very timely because hasn't the FBI just recently been hit with some of their names being posted online?
You know, there continue to be a number of these hacks into federal government computer systems, and certainly a number of high-profile incidences we've seen over the last few years. And, you know, this is all coming on the same day that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, testified before lawmakers and said that he feels one of the top dangers facing our country right now is our vulnerability to cyber attacks, especially those by foreign powers such as Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea.
The president, when you talked about some of these outdated computers, how outdated was he talking about?
Well, you know, the example that he gave went back to the 1960s. So sometimes when we stop and we start talking about computer systems, it's hard to remember that computers have not actually been around for that long, and that they certainly haven't been used at the level at which we're really using them now. For that long, but it just goes to show you how quickly computer systems and computer technology gets outdated so quickly that it's something that we have to work on all the time to stay on top of.
In this election year, is there bipartisan support for this, or is this something that's just going to languish until a new president comes in?
So that will be really interesting to see. You know, the president said this is something he's already brought up with in his meetings with Republican leaders, and that he fully expects this particular issue, cybersecurity of the U.S. government and also of our major corporations, he believes there will be bipartisan support on this issue. However, funding for this issue is part of the overall broader budget process. And, you know, we don't expect that to happen very quickly. The president, again, sending Congress his budget today, but nobody believes in an election year that Congress is going to come to any agreement on the overall budget until after the election in November.
And what level of alert would you say the president was at when he was talking about some of this? How afraid should we be as a country?
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure how to rank what alert level he was. I mean, certainly, as you pointed out, I mean, there was another reported hack just yesterday. So, you know, the president is stressing that this is a top priority for the country and that it's something that we have been working on, but he thinks we are just have not been doing enough and we just have to do better.
ABC News correspondent Bozzy Kanani with us from Washington this morning via Skype. That's the opening bell for today. Our producer is Mary Sandberg. Production help from Ross Cochran, Kevin Powell. Our engineer this morning, Ben Cortez. Have a great day. We'll see you bright and early here tomorrow morning for the opening bell. The Steve Cochran Show is next.